Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Here and Now Anytime. Before we start the show, I just want to say thanks to everyone who has donated to public radio this year. We rely on your support to keep bringing you all the news and podcasts that you love from across the NPR network for free. And we can only do that because of donations. So if you haven't donated yet, give now at donate.npr.org/now. And if you like Here and Now Anytime and you want to help us out even more, share the show with a friend and help us spread the word. And thanks. Now here's today's episode.
The conservatives felt like, why do we keep winning at the polls and losing in the courts? And they looked across the aisle at the behemoth, the ACLU, which remains very well funded and powerful. And they thought, we need our own version.
Inside the conservative Christian group that's racking up a winning streak at the Supreme Court. It's Thursday, December 14th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, how oil companies are reacting to the first ever global agreement to cut fossil fuels, and Arlington National Cemetery plans to remove a monument to Confederate General Robert E. Lee. The cemetery calls it a mythologized version of the Confederacy.
It touches upon every central element of the Lost Cause narrative.
But first, with the news this week that the Supreme Court will hear a case challenging access to mifepristone, we're going to take a closer look at one of the groups pushing the case that would make it harder for people to get the drug. Mifepristone is used for abortions, but also miscarriage care. The Alliance Defending Freedom was behind several major legal victories for conservatives in recent years. They helped overturn Roe v. Wade. They backed the designer who didn't want to make a website for a same-sex marriage. And their winning streak continued earlier this year when an anti-abortion judge in Texas suspended the FDA's approval of mifepristone. The Justice Department and the drug's manufacturer are appealing, but however that goes, it's high time to take a look at the influential group behind the case, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and we've got David Kirkpatrick for that. He profiled ADF for The New Yorker, and he told Robin Young that their legal portfolio is broad.
They've been involved in some cases involving restrictions during the pandemic to stop the spread of the disease, fighting that on behalf of churches and others. They've been involved in questions about the separation of church and state in terms of building a playground for a Lutheran church school in Missouri. So lots and lots of things.
Well, now we know the conservative movement post Richard Nixon's fall vowed to create their own media. Fox News was born. Think tanks, the Heritage Foundation. This group seemed to be a response to the ACLU. You write that James Dobson from Focus on the Family and others turned to a young lawyer named Alan Sears. You write he told donors he was going to follow the civil rights movement in designing it. How so?
You have to roll back the clock to around 1992 when the organization was created. At that point, it looked to conservatives like they had won three presidential elections, promising to appoint conservative justices. Those presidents had named five Supreme Court justices, and yet, again and again, the Supreme Court and the appellate courts were making liberal decisions, protecting, you know, separation of church and state, limiting prayer in schools and public places, and reaffirming the right to abortion. The conservatives felt like, why do we keep winning at the polls and losing in the courts? And they looked across the aisle at the behemoth, the ACLU, which remains very well funded and powerful, and they thought, we need our own version. And that is how they set out to create the ADF. And they recruited Mr. Sears, who at that time was best known as the author of the Meese Report, commissioned by the Reagan administration to study pornography and its ill effects.
Yeah.
From their point of view, you know, and this is what all interest groups involved in appellate law really do now. Mm-hmm. They see the model of the African-American civil rights movement, which was to sort of stretch and incrementally push back the precedents you don't like by finding attractive plaintiffs and finding those attractive plaintiffs in places where you can get a ruling in one direction from one appellate court and in another direction from another appellate court, and thereby advance the issue to the Supreme Court. So that's the kind of blocking and tackling that those groups did on the left and now on the right with ADF?
Well, you know, again, in the ADF, they're not being physically denied entry anywhere. They're not forbidden to marry who they love. But in their approach, they position themselves as victims.
Well, here's the paradox. We're talking at a time when they're on a terrific winning streak in the courts. But from their point of view, I think they can rightly say that they are on a losing streak in the culture. 15 years ago, there were sizable majorities in this country opposed to same-sex marriage. Now, same-sex marriage is the law of the land established by the Supreme Court, and it's increasingly popular and accepted. So from ADF's point of view, they do feel, in a sense, like conservative Christians who hold their values are increasingly a minority. From their point of view, there is a new orthodoxy, as they would call it, that treats LGBT people like they're a minority that deserves special protection, that is, I think, broadly accepting even of abortion. And in that context, they feel vulnerable within the culture, and they would like to find protections from the courts.
Well, circle back to Mifepristone. As you write, the ADF lawyers never thought that they would win in the lower court as they did. They didn't think this was going to make its way, as it has, to the Supreme Court, especially since you write how Amy Coney Barrett and some other of the justices have relationships with the ADF. What is your sense now of what happens?
Well, I can't make any predictions about what the Supreme Court is going to do. When the Supreme Court declined to consider this case when it was first brought up last year, I know Justice Samuel Alito wrote a quite vituperative dissent. So he's somewhat tipped his hand that he's sympathetic to the ADF side of this issue. I mean, what's remarkable here is that ADF, which once considered really quite on the margins of the legal world, is now very much mainstream, so much so that, as you mentioned, Justice Amy Coney Barrett has spoken before she became a judge at ADF events. She and Justice Samuel Alito have both taken clerks who came out of ADF training programs. ADF was able to cleverly bring this case in front of a Texas district court judge who they knew to be very much like-minded on abortion issues. So they've become increasingly mainstream. And with the way that the Supreme Court has changed, it's become much more of an open question whether arguments like this one, which a decade ago might have seemed outlandish, might have some success.
And coming back to the funding, where else does the ADF, which is huge at this point, where do they get their funding?
You know, I was able to obtain an internal conference call, a recording of an internal conference call among their fundraising department. And honestly, as much as people on the left like to imagine that a group like ADF is funded by a handful of millionaires someplace, they're spending a lot of energy cultivating a lot of relatively small donors, you know, wealthy individuals who might have a little bit of money to spare. But I think we have to keep in mind that any interest group has to, in a sense, be afraid of winning. You know, if you accomplish something like taking down Roe v. Wade, as ADF did, you've got to look for the next battle in order to keep your donors motivated. And I think bringing up this Mifepristone case has the added advantage of revitalizing and re-energizing that donor base. And I think that's partly what's happening here.
That's New Yorker staff writer David Kirkpatrick talking about the Alliance Defending Freedom. That's the ADF, the group leading the challenge to Mifepristone at the Supreme Court. David, thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up next, COP28. Some called it a cop-out. Others, the beginning of the end for fossil fuels. But what does it really mean? After the break, Scott Tong digs into the economic implications of the latest UN climate deal, both for oil companies contending with the first ever global agreement to wean off fossil fuels, and for renewables looking at a potential windfall. Stick around.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Humana. Your employees are more than your coworkers. They're the heartbeat of your business. That's why Humana offers modern group benefits designed to protect employees and their families with dental, vision, life, and disability coverage. Humana knows every employee and every business is unique. That's why they listen to your needs and build plans with you and your team in mind. That's the power of human care. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy: family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
The climate summit known as COP28 is now over, with countries pledging to transition away from fossil fuels and to triple renewable energy. So how do these words translate into action? We are, of course, talking about gigantic entrenched energy industries, say oil and gas drillers and refineries, power plants that in many cases burn coal to make electricity. For where all this goes, let's bring in Ali Velshi, anchor and economics correspondent at MSNBC. Hey, Ali.
Hi, Scott.
So tripling the capacity for renewable energy and nuclear energy by 2030, that's in this deal. You have seen, you know, say offshore wind deals in this country collapse. They're struggling because these projects are more expensive than the companies and their investors initially thought. What are you watching for now in the green energy space?
Well, let's talk about the fact that this is the first time that the COP28, the COP summit, there are a series of them, has called for a transition away. But there was a big argument about whether transition away from fossil fuels should be used or phase out, which is what some people wanted. They didn't do that. Remember, everything that happens here is non-binding anyway. So it's really just a sentiment. The issue is that the world is going to keep on using a lot of oil and gas. We're probably going to peak around 2030. The oil and gas industry thinks that we're going to keep on going at that level probably for a couple of decades. Right now, oil and gas makes up 55% of the energy mix. So most people agree we can phase out coal and we can use natural gas to make electricity, but that's still gas. Whether you move to wind or renewables like solar, that becomes, or nuclear, that becomes an issue. And that's what the oil producing countries are fighting against, to say, let's talk about other technologies to mitigate fossil fuel pollution as opposed to just renewables. So there's no particular agreement about whether we're going headlong into renewables or whether we're just trying to be sort of cleaner about our dirty oil and gas practices.
Well, one of these technologies, of course, is we've heard about carbon capture to extract the CO2 from a big factory's before it goes out the smokestack, or to take it out of the air. Is that what you're talking about? Those technologies would allow a lot of these fossil fuel industries to continue.
Yes, that's exactly one of the types of technology they'd like to talk about. But here's the problem. Carbon capture happens to be extremely costly, but that's okay because over time, prices do come down even for renewables. It's also extremely energy intensive, so it burns other types of energy in order to clean fossil fuels. But yeah, the oil producing companies and countries and OPEC would like you to think, hey, let's capture the carbon and keep on using fossil fuels. That doesn't tend to be as feasible as it thinks, as you think. It would probably make more sense to invest in bringing the cost of real alternative energy down, or making it more palatable in the case of nuclear energy. Some countries want it, other countries don't want to touch it. In America, we don't expand on our nuclear electricity generation. So this is where the debate is. I would say that it's interesting that we're even having this debate at COP28, because this is an industry that is typically led by the coal, gas, and oil companies and countries. So the idea that it's even happening there is interesting.
Yeah. What else to look forward to coming out of COP28?
Well, the fact that there's some agreement. This has been a very controversial meeting. It was held in the United Arab Emirates, chaired by the head of that country's oil company. So this is one of those that it's just been a lot of controversy. The idea that any agreement came out of it is intriguing to me.
That is MSNBC's Ali Velshi. Ali, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Scott reports on the impending removal of Robert E. Lee's statue from Arlington National Cemetery. We'll consider the statue's impact, as well as lawsuits underway to keep it where it is. That's after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. The right agent can make or break your home search. That's why Homes.com provides an agent directory that details each agent's experience so you can find the right one and ultimately the right home. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori. Jump into a new perspective on performance apparel. Vuori makes products that stand the test of time and hope to inspire others to live vibrant, healthy lives, empowering your best life in clothing that can be worn for just about any activity, from running to yoga. Visit Vuori.com/NPR to receive 20% off your first purchase and enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75. Discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
History, as we know, is a contested space. Where I live in Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., a high school once known as Washington and Lee has dropped the Lee, as in Robert E. Lee. Lee Highway, by my house, has been renamed. But a big, big change is now coming to nearby Arlington National Cemetery. A giant memorial to the Confederacy, which has stood for more than a century, is to be removed by the end of the year. That's after decisions by Congress and the Pentagon. The cemetery calls this memorial a nostalgic, mythologized version of the Confederacy. In other words, largely a fiction. And this view is often called the lost cause.
It touches upon virtually every lost cause theme, every central element of the lost cause narrative.
So last month, I asked historian Leslie Rowland at the University of Maryland to visit the memorial with me. We circled around the structure. It's in a quieter section at the back of the cemetery. And then, since they don't allow interviews in the cemetery, we stepped outside the fence to chat.
If you were to describe the essence of the lost cause argument, what is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the key elements are, first, that secession and fighting for a separate nation was not because of defending slavery, but was based on states' rights. This is a retroactive explanation that's not supported by the documentation at the time. A second key argument is that the Confederacy was defeated, but not really defeated, that it was simply overwhelmed by the larger resources of the North. And thirdly, that the constitutional causes for which they fought make them patriots, not traitors.
To be clear, she says these are all false or misleading narratives. I also asked her about the Latin inscription on the south side of the monument.
This is a Latin inscription that's a quotation from an ancient Roman poet. Roughly translated, it says, "The victorious cause, that is, Caesar becoming the dictator, was pleasing to the gods, but the lost cause, preventing him from being a dictator, pleased Cato." And Cato was noted for his moral integrity. Now, the message here is that the defeated cause, the lost cause, was in fact the morally superior cause.
Now, by design, this is an imposing structure. Now, picture this. A sea of gravestones, 3.5 feet tall, and rising above a bronze structure 10 times higher, with the figure of a female at the top.
And she's dressed in classical garb. On her head is a wreath of olive leaves, which signals peace. But in her left hand, she's holding out a laurel wreath. And the laurel was a symbol in the ancient world. It was awarded to the victor in war or in a competition.
So she's holding these laurels She's declaring that these Confederate soldiers beneath me are the victors.
Yes.
As this memorial is slated for removal, a lot of Southerners and military families are furious. Many spoke out over the summer during public comments on Zoom.
My name is Kirk David Lyons. I'm from Black Mountain, North Carolina. I have 31 Confederate ancestors who I guess under the current administration would be considered as traitors to this country, but they served honorably in duty and resisted an illegal invasion. It would be a crime against art and a crime against humanity to take the Confederate Reconciliation Memorial down.
My name is David West. As a gay American and a person trained in graphic design, I am appalled that the U.S. Army would seek to destroy a memorial sculpted by Moses Ezekiel, who was not only Jewish, but was also gay. The Army now prides itself on being inclusive and diverse, yet this proposed removal lies in direct opposition to those goals.
Hello, my name is Jennifer London. My husband is buried in Arlington Cemetery. Someday I hope to be buried with him. His ancestors fought in the Confederacy. Mine were aligned with the North. It is unfortunate that slavery has been placed entirely on the back of the Confederacy. Less than 25% of Confederate soldiers were slave owners, while almost 500,000 slaves also existed in the North.
For all the disputes over the Civil War and slavery, this monument actually went up 5 decades after the war, in 1914. It was approved by the U.S. Secretary of War and bankrolled by a fundraising behemoth known as the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
The United Daughters of the Confederacy had been organized in 1894. To be a daughter, you had to be a descendant of the Confederate generation. Their principal goal was to vindicate Confederate soldiers and other members of the Confederate generation. They also romanticized the South before the Civil War, and they're making a story that are about their own mothers and fathers and grandparents, that they were kind masters, slavery was not a harsh institution, and so they're putting forward a sanitized, romanticized version of the pre-Civil War South.
So the daughters commissioned sculptor Moses Ezekiel to design this memorial. He's a Confederate veteran. And he draws up a series of human figures carved around the base of the structure.
He explicitly said that he wanted to include these, what he called loyal slaves, faithful slaves, that he wanted to include them as a way of correcting what he described as the lies that Harriet Beecher Stowe had told about slavery in her 1852 novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin. So he's explicitly correcting, that's his word, negative images of slavery.
There is, along the sides of the memorial, several life-size humans carved there.
But among those figures is this enslaved woman who was portrayed as a black mammy. That is, she cared for the white children of her owner's family. And she is holding a baby, the baby of her master who claims her as property, as he's going to war. She's holding the baby for him to kiss goodbye. And she herself is weeping as he's departing for war. Entirely sanitizing slavery and entirely erasing the enslaved people who worked against the Confederacy, who ran away the Union lines, 200,000 who served in the Union Army, and so on.
And she adds, those who spied for the North. In 1914, when the memorial is unveiled, a book about it by the head of the Arlington Confederate Monument Association restates Lost Cause myths, that the Civil War was followed by the horrors of Reconstruction. But years later, after Reconstruction effectively ended, the book says, quote, American manhood had triumphed, Anglo-Saxon civilization had been saved, end quote. Historian Leslie Rowland says, by the early 20th century, the Lost Cause argument was not some fringe theory. It was gaining followers among segregationists across the country.
The 1890s was a very dramatic decade in race relations. In 1896, the infamous Plessy v. Ferguson decision in the Supreme Court, in which the Supreme Court gave the okay to legally required racial segregation. The 1890s are also a decade in which the largest number of lynchings of African Americans took place. By 1914, when this monument's dedicated, there's growing concern, enormous concern, about the huge number of immigrants entering the U.S. So this racialist thinking had taken hold really nationwide with many dissenters and critics, but it was becoming dominant not only in the South, but also in the North.
Again, this Confederate monument at Arlington Cemetery is due to be removed by year's end. But the clock is ticking, and there are lawsuits to keep it there. Another option is to move it to a Civil War museum elsewhere in Virginia with far fewer visitors. For her part, historian Leslie Rowland says most Confederate monuments are, in her words, overtly white supremacist, and that it's time to stop honoring them.
Scott Tong, reporting from Arlington National Cemetery. You know, the work Scott and everyone involved with this show does takes time and money to do. And this show is free, all of it. We're not asking for your subscriptions on Patreon or anywhere else. There's no paywall. Instead, our work and everything you hear across the NPR network relies on listeners like you to support public radio and podcasts. So if you can, give today at donate.npr.org/now. It really makes a difference. And if you've already donated, or you're not in a position to right now, one thing you can do that might help us out even more, actually, is help spread the word and tell a friend who might like the show about us. And thanks. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Gabrielle Healy, Kalyani Saxena, and Jill Ryan. Today's editors were Julia Corcoran, Peter O'Dowd, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Theme music by me, Mike, and Max Liebman. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.